I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. 2008 was a great year for cities until the economic crisis overtook us all. To close out the year, we're reprising some of my favorite guests to share their wisdom to make 2009 a better year for cities. From the entrepreneurial spirit of Bryant Park Corporation's Dan Biederman to Ed Glaser's riveting historical view of cities, from fascinating trends like Alan Ehrenhold's demographic inversion to the green initiatives of Seattle, brought to us by Mayor Greg Nickels. We've got the best of the best on this week's show. Plus, our regular contributors, Walker Smith and Nate Berg, offer their takes on the year's biggest stories. Stick around for the best of Smart City 2008. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Alan Ehrenhold is executive editor of Governing Magazine, and he wrote this year about the growing trend of cities reversing decades of affluent flight, which he calls demographic inversion. Alan, in the New Republic this month, you wrote about the demographic inversion of the American city. What happened?
Well, the demographic inversion is pretty simple. It basically means that the pattern of the last half century, in which we've gotten so used to, that is, affluent people moving out of the city and into the suburbs, and the inner city being the preserve of poor people, is gradually being reversed. And over the course of the next generation, I predicted, city centers will be the place where people who have a choice can live, and newcomers, immigrants, and the poor are more likely to live on the outskirts. And in fact, that's what cities historically have been like. If you think about 19th century Paris or Vienna, rich people lived on the inside and poorer people and immigrants lived on the outside. 30 years ago, there was an election for mayor in Chicago. Michael Bolandic was the incumbent. The primary was in March. He was running against Jane Byrne. In February, there's 20 inches of snow. And the CTA isn't running very well. It doesn't run very well now, but it really wasn't running very well in a snowstorm. And so the trains would fill up in the outer stations toward the suburbs with middle-class white people. And by the time they got to the inner city, they were so full they weren't even stopping. And blacks and Hispanics got so angry that they took their anger out on Bolandic, and he was beaten in the primary by Jane Byrne. Well, I tell the story, and then I say, this couldn't happen now. And that's not because of climate change, and it's not because the CTA works perfectly. It's because the people left stranded in the inner city would be all the rich people, because that's who's living there now, and the train would be filled with immigrants and poorer people getting on at the further reaches of the city.
How did this happen?
I think it's happened for a lot of reasons. The one people are going to think of most immediately is $4 a gallon gasoline, but that clearly isn't most of it. If you think about the ways cities have changed since the 1970s, there are a couple of things that are worth mentioning. One is that they are not, for the most part, grimy industrial precincts the way they were 100 years ago. We don't make much of anything in cities anymore. So the kind of noisy, dirty, somewhat off-putting environment that confronted anybody who came to an inner city or a downtown in the early 20th century or through the mid-20th century especially, that's pretty much gone. Second, anybody who's middle-aged these days knows what it was like 30 years ago to walk the streets of a central city and to be nervous about the person who was behind you and thinking there was a pretty good chance of your being mugged. That's a fear that has largely gone away since the early 1990s. Crime rates are much lower than they were. And my experience in particular is that people under 25 have absolutely no fear or virtually no fear of random crime, which brings up the final point that I'll make on this, that you've got a generation of kids raised in the suburbs with a vague sense that the excitement is in the city and who aren't much drawn to cul-de-sac suburbia. We could talk about why that's true, but one of the most popular television programs in that age demographic been in the last decade, things like Seinfeld, Friends, Sex and the City. It hasn't been the Brady Bunch or some new version of it. So lots of things seem to be working together. I'm not arguing that television shows are bringing the cities back. I'm merely saying that all of this seems fits together, and doesn't necessarily mean that all cities are recovering or that there is a renaissance. I'm fairly careful in avoiding that kind of blanket statement. I'm not a cheerleader. Merely that I think increasingly we will see that people who have a choice will choose to live in the center, and people who have less of a choice will be forced to live further away.
Are people surprised by what they find living in cities? Are they still trying to hang on to some hybrid lifestyle complete with car and suburban quiet?
Most people who are willing to move to the central city don't want to give up their cars. In fact, they're putting up a building in Charlotte, downtown Charlotte right now, where you're going to be able to drive into the building garage and the elevator will take your car up to your apartment. But the desire of people to live in central cities is not necessarily a desire to give away their cars. I certainly wouldn't claim that it is. The major conflict that you tend to have in some of these cities is you have baby boomers. They move downtown, and then they find that there are nightclubs all around them. And they don't think that's such a bad thing. I mean, it means that they're in a lively, thriving part of the city. But you may have noticed this, nightclubs tend to stay open kind of late, and they're a bit loud. And so you have a clash between the baby boomers who go to bed earlier and earlier, and the kids who want to party later at night. And it reminds me of the people who move out to the country and are surprised that pigs don't smell very good. But people sometimes change lifestyles, and they expect to bring some of the old lifestyle with them. And that can't always be done.
How do you respond to critics like Joel Kotkin, who dismiss this idea that cities are coming back by saying, oh, it's just a tiny blip in the statistics?
Well, it could be a blip, but it could also be a snowball rolling downhill. I think my answer to Joel, for whom I have a lot of respect, is that things happen one step at a time. Cities are not going to change dramatically overnight. They are changing rather noticeably. And I think he would argue that until you get families with small children and functioning and decent schools in central cities, you won't really have an urban revival. Well, my personal opinion is that education is not the first piece of the puzzle. It's closer to the final piece. First, you have singles and couples, gays, moving into the center of cities. Then you have people with very small children who stay for a while. Then they put their children in the elementary school, and then you will have an urban area that is family-oriented. Lower Manhattan has a larger average household size than the rest of Manhattan. But does that mean that people with four kids who now live out in the exurbs are all going to be flocking into the city in the next few years? No, of course not. More people have moved to the suburbs in this decade than have moved into the city. So, I mean, Joel is right about the numbers. Where I think he's wrong is about the significance of all this, and particularly the significance of a young urban elite gathering together in proximity in the center of American cities. I think that's very important.
Alan Ehrenhalt is the executive editor of Governing Magazine, as well as the author of the book, The Lost City, The Forgotten Virtues of Community in America. Harvard professor Ed Glaser is a prolific writer, an expert on how cities work, and an expert on enterprise and entrepreneurial economic development. So when Ed talks about why cities are the way they are, I listen.
The big story of the 20th century for cities was the remarkable changes in transportation costs. The real costs of moving a ton a mile by rail declined by more than 90% over the 20th century, and that's not even counting the even larger revolution created by the internal combustion engine. As a result, all of those cities, like Buffalo, Detroit, like Chicago, Minneapolis, were hit enormously hard in the middle decades of the 20th century as population dispersed within the metropolitan area and as manufacturing moved to places that had cost advantages, whether or not those were originally suburban areas, such as Henry Ford's River Rouge plant or right-to-work states in the South. These places that were built on transportation cost advantages naturally lost their comparative advantage when those transportation advantages disappeared. As that happened, every one of the American cities that had thrived based on this water-based or rail-based transport model was hit enormously hard in the middle years of the 20th century. There were some cities that were able to reinvent themselves, and that's sort of the interesting thing about what's happened over the last 30 years, is whereas in 1976, New York City and Buffalo looked like they had a lot in common, so did Boston and Detroit, so did Minneapolis and St. Louis. But some of those older, colder cities managed to come roaring back. And they came roaring back basically as centers for pro- production of ideas because they were able to excel in innovative industries. The variable that predicts success among older, colder cities overwhelmingly is the share of the population with college degrees as of 1960 or 1940. Just did much, much better. And I think the right model of this is that the same density that once served to get hogsheads onto clipper ships came to serve to connect smart people so that they learn from one another. And the same, this facility that urban areas have always had to speed the flow of ideas and to create chains of innovation. Think about the chain of geniuses that created the Italian Renaissance, the idea of linear perspective that moves Brunelleschi to Donatello, who takes it into low relief sculpture, to Masaccio, who puts it on the wall of the Brancacci Chapel, to his student Fra Filippo Lippi, to his student Botticelli. This chain of ideas, that's exactly the same sort of thing that happened that resurrected New York. It's a chain of ideas about thinking about trade-offs between risk and return, which starts actually in academia in the University of Chicago 50 years ago and then moves to Wall Street in the 1960s. And then as people become more sophisticated in thinking about risk-return trade-offs, Michael Milken is able to sell riskier junk bonds, riskier high-yield debt to people. Henry Kravis is able to use that high-yield debt to take over companies. Lou Ranieri is able to convince banks to invest in mortgage-backed securities. And Michael Bloomberg is able to make billions by selling people the data tools that they'll need to use these new ideas about trading off risk and return. Again, it's sort of a chain of innovations from people who were very close to each other, who learned from one another. And that's really what made New York come back. And you see in general an enormous ability of the average skills in the area to predict how high the wages are that people are receiving. You see a very strong tendency of places that started off with a slight skill advantage to become increasingly more skilled over time as skilled people have rushed into those areas. Now, all this work is done with formal measures of human capital, like share of the population with college degrees, and there clearly is a lot about what skills are in a city that's more intangible than that. But that's really what these downtown areas that have come roaring back are all about. And that leaves us with Buffalo, right, which is a low-skilled city, and it's very, very hard to see how Buffalo will be able to come back. Its one-time advantages in terms of its place on the Great Lakes and the Erie Canal just aren't worth that much anymore. From a public policy perspective, we may have an obligation to help poor people, but we don't necessarily have an obligation to see that every spot in the country has large amounts of economic activity in it. There's no conceivable public policy reason why we want huge numbers of factories locating on the foothills of the Rockies. In the same way, there's nothing wrong with cities like Buffalo shrinking, as long as they're doing as good a job as possible at taking care of their citizens. And I think one of the great tragedies of urban policy over the last 50 years is that we have paid far too much attention to structures and far too little attention to people. The hallmark of a declining city is it has a lot of infrastructure relative to people and economic activity because it was built in an era in which there was a lot more going on. Over time, the number of people has thinned out, but the amount of buildings and structures have remained high. It's very strange to think the right response to that is to build more structures in those places. And this sort of strange tendency to pursue a will-o'-the-wisp of rebuilding the population in declining places, I think distracts from the much more important job of making sure that every child growing up in every impoverished neighborhood in the country has the best chances they can, no matter where they're going to live.
If you were, though, mayor of Buffalo, and in that case, you are responsible for place as well as people, what would you do?
You know, I think it is certainly true that there are many people-based goals which are delivered at the place level, right? So children deserve safe streets, and we deliver safety at the place level. Schools are also place-based. But I would certainly do my best to make sure that any place-based policy I was following was very tightly tied to delivering things for people. I would focus primarily, I'd focus every bit of energy I have on figuring out how to make the school system more effective. I would take pride in those people that left Buffalo or left any city and went someplace else and succeeded, who were produced by the Buffalo school system. I mean, that's something that you should be proud of. I would also focus on simple quality of life objectives, which are safe streets, which are fast commutes, which are low taxes, and with the understanding that the stories of urban comeback are really ones of grassroots entrepreneurship created by smart people, right? So the goal of urban policy, if you want to rebuild the place, is to attract smart people and then basically try to get out of their way. It's not to engage in industrial policy. It's not to think that in City Hall you're going to be able to micromanage which industries are going to do well and which industries are going to do poorly. The best thing you can do is to make your city as attractive a place as possible and then, you know, hope for the best in terms of people coming in. But most of all, pay attention to educating the children that are growing up in your area and to making sure that they have as much safety as they can.
Two questions you raised for me. One, attract smart people, get out of their way. That makes perfect sense, of course. But if you're on a downhill slide or, you know, the trajectory is wrong, then how do you attract smart people?
You know, again, I think it's basically quality of life strategies. So the problems are harder for Buffalo, which is not close to another metropolitan area where there's easy spillovers, and they are, say, in Lowell, Massachusetts, or Newark. One of the strategies for places that are on the outskirts of a thriving metropolitan area is that you have a lot of opportunity to attract people who are being priced out of New York or priced out of Boston. And I think this is a strategy that's being followed by a number of different people. I hear that this is sort of an idea that's going on in Milwaukee of trying to make sure that they're getting anyone who feels that they can't afford to do business in Chicago, although Chicago is a pretty business-friendly place to begin with. But those areas have at least a clear path that they can be the lower-cost alternative if they can make their city attractive enough for people coming in. I think thinking particularly about how you're going to fix the school system is a big deal, right? I mean, the great thing about good schools is they don't just produce better educated children, but they also attract parents who are interested in education, and that's got to be a good thing as well. So I'm certainly intrigued by experiments like that going on in Kalamazoo, where children who grow up in the area have some of their college paid for if they graduate and then go on to college. Things like that that aren't particularly education-centered make a lot of sense to me.
Ed, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ed Glaser is a professor of economics at Harvard University. And now for our year-in-review news wrap-up, we go to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
The downturn in the global economy was the defining issue of 2008. It has affected nearly every aspect of American life, and specifically many cities. The tumbling stock market and reduced consumer spending have slowed commerce in the U.S., and as a result, tax revenues are down in many cities. With less money in general funds and little hope for a rapid rebound, cities across the U.S. are being forced to make cuts into their budgets. Lights are being dimmed and parades are getting canceled in efforts to reduce unnecessary spending. But some cities are focusing on budgets many might consider untouchable, like public safety services. Police and firefighters typically make up the bulk of a city's budget, and some cities are now looking at revamping these operations to cut costs. Others, like Philadelphia and Atlanta, are dealing with the downturn by simply cutting jobs. With no clear end to the recession in sight, cities are undoubtedly going to continue to feel the pain. How much pain there is will largely be determined by how creatively cities adapt to a less prosperous future. And one bellwether of tough economic times this year has been the rash of foreclosed homes that has spread across the country. Bad loans and falling property values have forced thousands of Americans out of their homes, often emptying entire neighborhoods. Suburban ghost towns have popped up around the nation in places like Riverside, California, much of suburban Phoenix, as well as central Florida. And with the economy in a sour state, values are expected to fall even further. Recent figures show that more than one quarter of American homeowners owe more on their mortgages than they could possibly hope to gain by selling their houses. Economists are estimating that the figure could rise to nearly 40% in 2009. With nearly half of the country's homeowners in this kind of trouble, the demand for federal action is likely to rise next year. And that may happen, as one of the important advancements for cities in 2008 was the election of Barack Obama as President of the United States. Obama is notably the first president to have grown up in cities since William Howard Taft was in office almost 100 years ago. Obama's experience as a community organizer in Chicago gives him a direct connection to the problems facing urban areas, and many in the field of planning are hopeful that this connection will shine through in the new president's policies. His election season rhetoric seemed to indicate that urban issues would play a big role in an Obama presidency. His campaign has stressed the need for new infrastructure investment, a more environmentally concerned energy policy, and a more regional focus to address the problems facing America's increasingly interconnected metropolitan areas. And also notable was the sharp rise in global oil prices in 2008 that had ripple effects around the planet. One of the major reactions in America was somewhat surprising. The amount of vehicle miles traveled actually went down for the first time in nearly 30 years. Even more surprising was the subsequent increase in ridership on public transit. The U.S. has never been known as a model for providing public transportation, but the high price of oil pushed many Americans out of the driver's seat and onto the bus. As ridership increased, many transit systems became overwhelmed. They didn't have enough buses or trains to handle the demand. The importance of providing funding for public transit suddenly became clear to millions of Americans, and they took this new conviction with them to the polls. The general election saw dozens of public transit funding bills pass all over the country, from Honolulu to Los Angeles to Seattle. Even in tough economic times, the public seemed to become incredibly willing to tax itself for the betterment of the nation's public transit systems. And with a new president entering office in early 2009, with a congressional majority behind him, many transit advocates are hoping America is entering into a renaissance of public transportation. It's not likely to happen overnight in 2009, but at the very least, the political wheels seem to be in motion. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Happy New Year, Nate. Coming up after the break, we'll have more of our favorite interviews from 2008, plus a year in review from City View's commentator, Walker Smith. I'm Carol Coletta.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard, they have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input, and we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that want to see cities thrive, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email. My personal email, I'm giving this out, Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. Send me an email, I'll send you an invite, join the conversation online. One more time, it's Scotty at smartcityradio.com. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Smart City, I'm Carol Coletta. Let's get back to our 2008 Best of Show. When Washington ignored climate change, Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels decided to ignore Washington. He convinced more than 800 mayors to sign on to the U.S. Mayor Climate Protection Agreement, and he is determined to make his city, Seattle, the model for sustainability. And we talked to him about what he's doing there earlier this year. Mayor, in the absence of federal action, you have led America's mayors to sign what has become known as the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement to meet the goals of the Kyoto Protocol. What was your inspiration for getting mayors to take action?
Well, Carol, the issue of global warming, while important, really was not a front burner issue for me when I became mayor. I became mayor right after September 11th, and so the economy and safety were the two important things. But the winter of 2004-2005 changed that for me. Previous to that, global warming seemed like an issue that was off in the future and maybe far away from the Pacific Northwest. But that winter, we had a very dry, very warm winter, and that's important because up in the Cascade Mountains, there was no ski season, which was a tragedy for skiers. But for the city of Seattle, it meant a lot more. We rely on snowpack in the Cascades, and when it melts, we capture that water and use it for our drinking water. And we also run it through turbines and use it for our electric power. So it was a very difficult time. And as the Kyoto Protocol went into law in 141 countries on February 16th of 2005, but not in the United States of America. I stood up and said that Seattle would take action to protect our Cascade Mountains, but I knew that if it were only Seattle, it would be purely symbolic, and that it's pretty hard to ask people to change their lives for something that is purely symbolic. So I challenged mayors to join with me. And our goal was to have 141 mayors, one for every country that had adopted Kyoto as law. We now, I'm very pleased to say, have 830 mayors who represent 79 million Americans. More than one in four Americans now lives in a city that's taking local action to reduce their impact on the climate. 79 million people represents about the population of Germany. And we've changed the conversation, and we now have 830 laboratories all working to figure out how we get this thing done.
Mayor, what's being done to measure the impact of the efforts?
The first thing that mayors ask me is, okay, I've signed this thing, now what do I do? And the first thing you need to do is figure out what impact you're having, which is measuring your emissions, your greenhouse gas emissions. And there's really no standard way to do that. That's one of the things that is a result of the federal government's failure to engage in this issue. They could provide a standard way to measure both the current emissions and the effectiveness of the things we do to reduce our emissions. So we've taken the best models that we are aware of in Seattle. We've measured our baseline emissions, and we've now measured what we believe the impact of the changes that we've adopted have been. And we're really proud to say that we believe that we are now 7%, 8% below 1990 levels, which is slightly a greater reduction than the Kyoto Treaty would have called for.
And your goal is?
Well, our goal is to reduce by the amount the Kyoto Protocol demands, which is 7% from 1990 levels by 2012. So we think we've at least initially achieved that. We're a growing city. So if we do nothing more, we will slip back and increase our emissions. So we're continuing the effort. The point to remember, though, is that Kyoto is only scratching the surface. We need to go an order of magnitude beyond Kyoto if, in fact, we're going to change this, what looks like inevitable global phenomena of climate disruption.
Many people agree that the greenest thing we can do is to get out of our cars. And yet one of your four priorities is to get Seattle moving. How does that contribute to making Seattle a more sustainable city?
Well, when we talk about getting Seattle moving, we're not saying we're going to move more vehicles and slam them into more freeways. We are trying to figure out how we change our transportation system into a 21st century sustainable system. So right now in Seattle, our first light rail line is under construction out to the airport. We've recently opened up our first modern streetcar line connecting downtown with the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. We are investing in bicycle trails and sidewalks so that people can get where they're going without ever getting into a vehicle. And we're promoting smart growth, which means that people will live much closer to downtown or in downtown, and perhaps their toughest transportation choice will be what color shoes do I wear on my walk to work.
Do the people of Seattle get it? Are they with you on this?
Well, I think one of the reasons that we were able to begin this Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement is the people of Seattle do get it. So when I stood up that day, I knew that I would have support from the people here. And in fact, they might even say, why haven't you gone further, Mr. Mayor? That made it possible for Seattle to start this effort. And what's been remarkable to me is how it has resonated throughout the country. The cities that are involved represent all 50 states and really every imaginable kind of city within our country.
What are the biggest challenges to you locally as mayor in making Seattle a green city?
A couple of things. We're a Western city. And Western cities have a couple of things in common. One, we grew rapidly after World War II, so that means we grew around the automobile, and our land use reflects that. Secondly, we have this dichotomy in the West. We hate sprawl, and we despise density. And you really cannot have it both ways. And so we had a two-year-long conversation about what kind of a city we wanted to have. And people told me they wanted a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week city. They wanted a great diversity of people and opportunities and activities. And then we talked about density as a tool to achieve that kind of a community. So we think, at least for the time being, we've resolved that dichotomy. We're encouraging much more dense residential growth in our downtown and our center city, and connecting that growth to our jobs much more easily than 30, 40, 50-mile commutes on the interstate.
Greg Nichols is mayor of Seattle, Washington. Dan Biederman doesn't run a city, but he runs very important parts of one very important city, New York. He's the co-founder of the Bryant Park Corporation in New York, a private organization that functions as a BID, a business improvement district. And he transformed Bryant Park in the center of New York from a dangerous and depressing eyesore to one of the best loved and most intensely used urban parks in the world. And I think what Dan learned doing that holds lessons for the management of public spaces in all of our cities.
One of the first things I did when I was hired was to look for models, and we looked at Rockefeller Center in New York, which pleased a lot of people, and the public spaces around the Rouse facilities in Boston and Baltimore, and also Disney. Even though it was private and you had to pay to get in, they were clearly pleasing a lot of people. So the vision really was get rid of all the bad things in the park at the time: drugs, graffiti, crime, serious crime. There were murders and rapes and robberies there galore, and make the park clean and safe, and then program it. And the vision was a new town square for Midtown Manhattan, right at the heart of the Central Business District.
What was it you learned from these models that you studied at Disney and Rouse and Rockefeller Center?
They clearly paid a lot of attention to detail. Retail was not a bad thing to put in urban spaces. Programming, things to make people come to the park, even in weather that's not perfect, because you have very few perfect weather days in Bryant Park. You might have 30 or 40 each year where the weather's just exquisite. You got to keep your clientele coming back when it's a little warmer or when there's a wind and it's a little cool in the fall. So we program very carefully based on some of the things we learned from other places.
What are the most important things you've learned about running a successful park that others can learn from?
First thing is, your female customer is your most important customer. If you please women, you will please everyone. Because women note dirt and they know danger much more than males do. Males will sit down next to a dangerous person and not even notice. Males will sit down with litter and the like. So we said we can't have that. We also have to have very good restrooms for them because they let us know that. So we made the park exquisitely clean. And we made the restrooms unusually luxurious and well-managed and clean, and then programmed with events that would draw female clientele, whether it's the arts or literature. We have a special appeal to gardeners. There are 67 million amateur gardeners in the United States, and we seem to have a good portion of them because they ask us questions about the flowers we have.
What have been your biggest challenges?
Well, to get it going, politics was the big challenge. New York is not a city that's friendly to private management. And what we were proposing was to take this park out of the public sector and move it into the private to some extent. We still New York City land, but it's really run by a private corporation. So that was the initial challenge. The challenge since has been to react to events occasionally, different mayors, still some politics, but also to keep it fresh. We really have made a great effort to keep the park complex, evolving, improving each year. One of my joys now is to go into the park and be behind a person who's explaining to a visitor how the park works, and it takes them a while. They wave their arms, they point in different directions, they say, let me explain to you what happens over there normally. They're not there today, but normally there's this and that. So it's really terrific that the park is a complex experience that people feel that they haven't gotten the hang of yet, and they keep coming back for more.
What do you mean by keeping the park complex?
As you walk on one of the paths, you will see an ever-changing group of events. You might see one day just a simple reading room, which is something no one else does, but we pioneered it. It's an outdoor library, in effect, in the park, and you can borrow the books and sit there and read magazines, newspapers, and the like. The next day, the library will still be there, but there will be an event with a well-known author who is describing his or her book and signing copies of it, just as might happen in a Barnes & Noble or a Borders. a little on beyond that, and there's some chess players who have made a little enclave for themselves under a certain tree, and there are six or eight different speed chess games going on, and they move around. And further, you're getting to the area where most people are on the web access system, Wi-Fi, where they're doing work, and they've stayed out of their office and decided to stay longer in the afternoon because it's a nice day. So you've got all kinds of little things going on that change. Therefore, the crowds are very large.
Dan, how do you manage physical encroachments on the park? How many are too many? I was there a few weeks ago during Fashion Week and couldn't get into the park. So how do you know when too much is indeed too much?
We don't have too many of them, first, Carol. And second, the city has agreed with us that eventually, because Fashion Week has grown so much, it's a wonderful event, but they need a bigger space and a more established flat, hard surface to be underneath them. So that's really the only event of its kind. Most of the other events that have any kind of private tinge to them are mostly concerts and the like in film series paid for by private parties, where the promotion of a product might be incidental, but the main thing is the public's being entertained. Fashion is not open to the public. By the way, while they're there, a large part of the park is still open to the public, and people just move their operations from the lawn to the surrounding, what we call LAs, where the trees are.
Why couldn't the city do Bryant Park on its own?
Well, the city people are actually quite smart and have emulated a number of things we've done. At the time we took Bryant Park over, the city was just coming out of its fiscal crisis. So it was a question partly of resources, partly they had 1,500 other parks, and it's hard to, when you've got such a big empire, to pay as much attention to a few of them. We subsequently went on and did two others, Herald and Greeley Squares down at 34th Street as part of our BID there. So we only run three of roughly now, I think, 1,700 parks in their empire. So it's a matter of focus and closeness to the customer, because we really know the people who surround the park, who would use it. We get support from their companies. So for a lot of reasons, it would have been hard for the city to do it exactly as we did. But the city, to its credit, has really emulated our techniques, and they've come up with a lot of their own, and they've done a very nice job in several other parks that serve business districts.
Dan Biederman is the president of the Bryant Park Corporation. He joined us from his office in New York City, and his interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. The very first interview I ever conducted on Smart City was with Richard Florida. It was just before the publication of his book, The Rise of the Creative Class, and since that time, Richard has become something of a phenomenon. This year, he published a new book, Hoosier City, and it's generated almost as much interest as that earlier book. And I had a chance to talk to Richard earlier this year about the cities that people aren't choosing.
I think from a public policy point of view, we had better figure out how we're going to cope with an increasingly not just economically and socially unequal world. And one of the things the book talks about is that if we don't address the spikiness, you know, by helping second and third tier cities cope, the political ramifications of this might be something we don't like. And I say what we don't want to do is end up making the world less spiky by chopping down the peaks. We want to make sure that the valleys have enough and are successful enough that they become legitimate and kind of reasonable and exciting places. I also think that would take the pressure off the housing prices, but I think it's a big, big issue for public policy. And I don't think it's something that mayors alone can address. I think mayors are the people who get it in the political realm, but I think it's something that at the national level and at the global level we're going to have to start to address.
Do you think that it is about coping, or do you think there are actually strategies that help the valleys begin to spike?
If you look at the history of capitalism, of economic development, one thing becomes incredibly clear. Time and space have been used much more intensively with each epoch of capitalism. So you had first that hunter-gatherer communities, then you had agricultural towns, then you had these kind of beginnings of mercantile cities, then you had the metropolitan area of cities and suburbs that we grew up in. Now you have this thing which I call and others call the mega region, which is this intensive use of time and space across metropolitan areas. This thing is just growing by leaps and bounds. And it's not a city to suburb, suburb to city, or the people moving back is a gentr. It's all part of the intensification of the use of space within and among these mega regions. I think for second and third tier regions that are outside of mega regions, it is a very difficult road. And it's got to go beyond coping, because they've got to figure out a way to connect to these very intensive, spiky, incredibly concentrated centers of economic activity. Let's take an example of one that would be a very good one. Stockholm or Copenhagen, outside of our own country, wonderful cities, but outside of mega regions. For Stockholm or Copenhagen to compete, they have to do everything much better than London or New York or Chicago or even Toronto might. They have to have much higher levels of human capital. They have to nurture and develop talent across the board. They have to offer extraordinarily high quality of life. And I think that's something U.S. cities have to learn from, that if you're a second or third tier city, it is not enough just to cope and offer up yourself as maybe a low-cost destination, that you really have a tough competition. And I think the smaller Scandinavian cities get this because they've been isolated in a way for so long. And they understand that if they're going to compete at a world scale, they really have to up the ante. North American cities are fantastic, and we have such a wide range. Many of them are doing great, but many of them are not coping effectively and are kind of just running along at half steam. And I think the ante has to be upped. You know, we're in a world economy now, and every city is competing against global competitors, whether we like it or not. So North American cities have to come up to the test.
What do you think urban leaders can do to attach you to place and to attach their citizens, their mobile citizens to place and call it home in a way that would encourage them to invest their time, their talent, their money, and their legacy?
You know, these are the things that keep me up at night. I don't think it's possible. I think we have a much more highly mobile population than anyone wants to admit. And in the book, I talk about three kinds of people: the mobile, the rooted, those of us who could be mobile and choose to stay in a place, and the stuck, those who can't move. Highly skilled people across fields, whether that's finance or arts, music, science, academia, highly skilled, highly talented people are incredibly mobile. And they move not only across state and city borders, they move across national borders. I just think of my colleagues in the academic world. So I think what we have on our hands is a situation in these creative or intangible industries where people are no longer stuck having to work where there's fertile soil or raw material or even large capital-intensive factories. We're talking about places for whom advantage is constructed. It has to do with human capital accumulation, but it can be very fleeting. And you have to understand that large fractions of your population, especially your talented population, are likely to move. So I've always said that. The key is not just generating talent. The key is not just retaining talent. The key has to be to attract people. And I think there's two or three ways places can attract people. One is obvious. You have to have an abundance of great and interesting economic opportunity. Two, you have to be, and I talk about this in the book, a safe and secure and reasonably high quality of life place to live. But three, most people these days are moving mainly for the reason that they want to express themselves through their career, through their jobs, through their lifestyle. The one thing that places can really do is become the kind of place that people feel comfortable expressing themselves. And I think one of the reasons Chicago has solidified its position among so many other Midwestern cities is that it almost is the one Midwestern city where people can self-express. I certainly think the Toronto shift from kind of a stodgy, old-school Anglo town to a dynamic, thriving metropolis attracting immigrants like crazy and building creative industries, entertainment industries, a better finance industry has lots to do with its role in being a place where people can self-express. But I do think it's going to be harder and harder for places to hold on to people. And I love Anna Lee Saxenian, my colleague at the University of California at Berkeley. She says it's no longer about, you know, brain drain. It's really about brain circulation. And if you can make your place a node in brain circulation, you know, if Chicago is a node or Toronto is a node or San Francisco or Hong Kong or London, that's what's really key. That's what places really need to do, not try to tack people's feet to the floor, but make it an attractive place for them to want to be. And if they want to leave, say that's fine, but, you know, maintain some kind of attachment, talk well of the place. And certainly don't push people out the door when they're going to leave, you know. Make sure that they're going to continue to function as ambassadors for your place.
Well, we always look forward to what's next from you, Richard. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, Carol, thanks for having me on.
Richard Florida's latest book is called Who's Your City? Throughout the year, Walker Smith has brought us essays on everything from gift-giving to political intrigue. Today, he gives us our City Views year in review and some things we may look forward to in 2009.
The first half of this year alone made it one for the record books. But the year as a whole is much more than that. It is the crack of dawn on a new era in American history. I know that this sounds overdramatic, but think back. The Democratic presidential primary season was itself groundbreaking enough to make this year one to remember. A hard-fought battle from January to June, it came down to a woman and an African-American man, and uncharacteristically, no concession was offered until after the last two primaries in South Dakota and Montana. Even the dreadful, sordid revelations of infidelity on the part of one of the other candidates, tinged as it was with a sour note of arrogance and elitism, did not, as it would have in years past, trivialize the significance of this primary season. For the first time in American history, an African American won the nomination of a major political party for President of the United States. Then, in November, he won. Inequality based on race goes back to the earliest roots of our nation. Slavery, worst of all, but racial inequality was even reflected in the original text of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, until it was modified by the 14th Amendment 3 years after a civil war was fought over slavery. This was followed by a century of struggle against the enduring legacy of racism. And now, Americans eagerly await the January 20th, 2009 inauguration of our first black president, Barack Obama. Of course, Obama has been on the job ever since his election because our economy is in serious trouble. This year saw an accelerating economic decline until a crisis was finally reached in October that required massive intervention by the federal government. More is needed and planned. The worst recession since the Great Depression is upon us, as is the end of the great bull market run of the 1980s and 1990s. Huge sectors of the American economy are teetering, including banks, automobile companies, newspapers, magazines, and retailers. In all likelihood, never again will America be able to enforce a global hegemony of free market capitalism like it has been able to do since the end of World War II. Obama's election signals two other important eras coming to an end in 2008 as well. One is the end of baby boomer domination of the social, political, and cultural agenda of America. This has been eroding for years, but many, including myself, had felt that boomers were too numerous and too engaged to yield power to a new generation. Yet it seems that most boomers no longer look to themselves for ideas and inspiration, and the evaporation of stock market wealth and 401ks has utterly demoralized them. One key part of this, by the way, is the breakdown of our grand social experiment with baby boomers in a market-based retirement system. Boomers are no longer on an upward yet slowing trajectory. They are, in fact, now in decline. The other era coming to an end is that of Republican political dominance. Since the Democratic Party cracked at its 1968 convention, a Democrat has occupied the presidency for a mere 12 years. 70% of the last 40 years have been led by Republican presidents. Obama's win and the strengthened Democratic majority in Congress have caused intellectual consternation among Republicans. Demographics do not bode well for them. The most ardent supporters of Republicans during this time have been white married Christians, the three demographic groups in the biggest relative decline in American society. The demographic groups in ascendance all vote heavily Democratic, something that will change the character of American life not through ideological conversion, but through the momentum of changing demographics. But more than demographics are changing. Obama will remake and then rechristen the very physical being of America itself. As the conservative pundit David Brooks recently noted in one of his regular columns in the New York Times, five huge problems are in need of solution by the federal government. These are the erosion of the American social contract, particularly health care, the looming oil shortage and the attendant environmental crises, the stagnation in human capital because of an educational system that no longer competes globally, the now obvious need for significant reforms in our financial systems, and the serious need for public works programs to shore up our crumbling infrastructure, particularly roads and bridges. Obama was already committed to these priorities, but with the pressing need for major fiscal stimulus to jumpstart the economy, he will have no choice but to fund all of these initiatives in a big way, and virtually all of them at once. America is now on the verge of being rebuilt almost from the ground up. This is what I think that 2008 will be remembered for the most. It has been a year of unprecedented events and sudden endings. It is literally a pivotal year because, unlike many important years in the past, the path of our future is going to pivot on the incredible events of this year. Most extraordinary of all will be the remaking of American community and civic life. Voters under 30 accounted for 90% of Obama's margin of victory in the popular vote. Support among voters under 30 was especially critical in the battleground states. This generation has reversed the declining turnout in voting that was true of young voters in the past, a pattern reflective of the greater civic sensibility found by every survey of this generation. There is an American revival afoot. It has been on the march for some time now, but the year just passed has truly set it in motion. We have lived through one of those few extraordinary years that shaped the future of American history. So much has changed forever in the past 12 months. Yet so much has taken root as well. A civic revival awaits us, and to it we will now progress. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Thanks, Walker, for another great year. It's been a good year for us here at Smart City. We've had plenty of feedback from you, and we want to hear more. Send us an email, questions@smartcityradio.com, or contact us through our website. And while you're there, you can listen to all of our past shows from 2008 and before, and you can subscribe to our podcast so new episodes get delivered straight to you. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our lampshade-wearing producer and engineer. Scotty, get down from there. I'm Carol Coletta.